with a Christian mission. Reflections on the works of a missionary and on the Assyrian case. By David Barsom Purley, JSD Secretary, Assyrian National Federation. The Cross on the Nestorian Monument, from Holmes Nestorian Monument. May the cross of Jesus be the protection of the servants of God. From an old Assyrian legend. The original in Aramaic above. Foreword. An earnest, public demand has impelled me to offer this new, revised, and enlarged edition to the citizens of the world. They should know more, I am assured, about the burning problem of the Assyrians. The subtitle to the first edition read, John Van Ness of the Foreign Missions of the Reformed Church in America persecutes the Assyrian race and church, and properly. In its a preliminary note I stated in substance. The manner in which the Reverend Dr. John Van Ness has brashly intruded himself on the subject of the controversy between Iraq and the Assyrians is not calculated to destroy hate between the two peoples. On the contrary, his revival of the unpleasant facts of the past may threaten to upset the present. His observations with reference thereto, on the other hand, are so misleading in fact as well as in logic that a defensive answer becomes a matter of urgent necessity. The Assyrians in Iraq are the heroic remnant of the once mighty empire of Nineveh and a Christian element of a most ancient and illustrious tradition. The Church of the East has contributed much throughout the centuries in service and martyrdom to maintain the cross of Christ, and but for this valiant church, the course of Christian history might have been changed. They speak Aramaic, the language in which the Master delivered his message to the world. During the crisis of 1933, forced conversion to Islam was the order of the day, while the proclamation of a holy war against the Assyrian infidels was responsible for the creation of a universal belief in the Arabs that the crisis was a war between the Crescent and the Cross. It is safe to say that this Christian missionary has played no mean part in the attempted process of de-Christianizing Christians in the East. His is conduct violative of every aspect of the genius of American institutions. These observations are intended as an ardent message to the Board of Foreign Missions of the Reformed Church in America. The wise course for it to pursue is to exercise a more cautious judgment in the selection of its representatives who may not deviate from the narrow path of divine righteousness and whose conduct may reflect honor upon the high ideals that inspired John Calvin, and the missionary enterprise of his church. I now appeal to the Church of Christ. And to America. Those interested in the problems of national refugees and minorities in the Middle East were startled by the publication in America of John Van Ness I, a friendly, indeed, a too complimentary book about the Arab, written in fulfillment of a promise he once had made to the late King Faisal of Iraq. It is a model eulogy to the valor and duplicity of the Arabs and a pietistic apology for the recrudescence of the jungle in one part of the East. The author was an American missionary of the Reformed Church stationed at Basra, Iraq, where he served the Arabs for 40 years without making the slightest impression upon them with the teachings of Christianity. His book is not limited to Iraq, however, it comprehends the entire Arabian Peninsula with a characteristic, dogmatic proposal for the solution of the problem of Palestine. This problem of Palestine is a lamentable one indeed. And were it not for too many such gratuitous offers of solution by self-appointed reformers, the simple Palestine problem would have remained simple, and the age-old solidarity between the two peoples would not have become corrupted in the Holy Land. While these comments have reference solely to the Iraqi-Assyrian dispute, not a review, it would not be amiss to state that the book is a sham and entirely devoid of merit both as a literary production, and as a source of information. It is written in a childish style and the chapters are marred by numerous inaccuracies which betray a certain superficiality of scholarship. As a source of information, it is a twisted and garbled tissue of mendacity and distortion of facts. What else could a book written with a preconceived bias contain? "The Arabs are my friends" is the opening sentence. When an author permits himself to become supersaturated with a blind admiration for the Arab and Arab viewpoint, he can no longer be disturbed by fawhi activities of such of their pro-fascist leaders as the Mufti of Jerusalem, erstwhile in Hitler's service in Berlin, or with those of the former Prime Minister of Iraq, Rashid Ali, and his clique, the Golden Square, who attempted a miserable Praxis putsch at a critical moment in this war, or with those of the Chief of Staff of the Egyptian Army who sought to hand over to the Nazis General Wavell's plan of action. Nor can his Christian conscience be perturbed by twisting the truth concerning the treacherous massacre of the non-combatant Assyrian Christians in 1933 by the Iraqi government, which, though inexcusable, says he, it was understandable too, for the Assyrian leaders had been cocky and provocative to the point of exasperation. What actually happened in the north of Mosul, the scene of the massacre, during the first weeks of August 1933, surpasses in horror anything imaged by Dante in his vision of hell. Some 65 villages, 3 were looted and destroyed. Women were raped and made to march naked. They were then ripped open with knives and made sport of while in a state of agony. Priests were slaughtered after being barbarously tortured, holy books placed over their bodies and burned with them. Little girls of 9-4 were raped and burned alive. When there was no one left to kill, the armored cars proceeded to dash backwards and forwards through the dead and dying. In all, 3,000 defenseless Assyrians, 5 were butchered. This massacre, noted for the black treachery in which it was conceived and the callousness with which it was executed, was preceded by the proclamation of a holy war 6 against the Assyrians and attempts made to forcibly convert them to Islam 7. There were 2 primary reasons why the Assyrians were being slaughtered: first, because of their loyal services to the British Empire 8, and, second, because of their proud refusal to purchase life at the price of apostasy to Islam 9. In the East, religious quarrels follow national lines and vice versa 10. Obviously, Dr. Van S. is either unwilling or unable to appreciate the Assyrian position and problem with any degree of fairness and candor. Here is an abstract of his observations, p. 151,153. The Assyrians, who lived in the Hakkari country in eastern Turkey, sided with the Russians against the Turks in World War I and were left out on a limb following the Russian debacle of 1917. They fought their way to Iraq, and numbers of them were enlisted by the British in the levies, financed and officered by the British. Being well-equipped and well-trained, and entirely Christian in religion, they incurred the resentment of the Iraqi government. When the League awarded Hakkari to Turkey, they demanded of Iraq a section of territory where they might settle as a single community with substantial autonomy. Iraq made generous arrangements for their settlement and administration, but there was no region available and sufficient to satisfy their demand. When Britain terminated its mandate in 1932, the Assyrians took matters into their own hands. 800 of them went into Syria, only to return within 2 weeks, and in the recrossing of the Tigris, they fired at the Iraqi post stationed there, which was, of course, rebellion. Fighting followed that resulted in the defeat of the vaunted Assyrians. Then came the massacre in Samil, which was the result entirely of local military decisions, and was not planned by the Iraqi government, the blame of which must be laid at the door of Bekir Sidki Pasha, who was himself assassinated shortly thereafter by one of his own men. A clear analysis of these observations will reveal the author's deliberate falsification of historical facts. 1. The Assyrians were led into their odyssey as a direct consequence of the attempt made by the Russian and more essentially by the British military authorities 11 acting under the instructions of the Eastern Committee of the War Cabinet, to make use of them as an allied unit against the Turks in World War I. This policy was prompted not only by an appreciation of the high fighting qualities of the Assyrians but also by the recognition of their strategic position venture in joining the Allies upon the solemn assurance of Britain on the mountains of Hakkari. The Assyrians made this desperate that they would obtain a firmer self-government under the aegis of conclusion independence would actually be guaranteed. 12. The fortunes of war did not smile, however, upon the Assyrians. A cruel fate pursued them, for, very early in the conflict of 1915, they were driven out of their homes and forced to flee to Persia. In 1917, the Assyrians were visited first by the emissaries of Major General L. C. Dunsterville 13, and later by Captain George F. Gracie of the British Intelligence Service, attached to the British military mission in Transcaucasus. Their visit resulted in a joint plan of action with the Russo-British forces, a plan that they followed to their own loss 14, for in so doing, they lost their former homes and two-thirds of their numbers 15. When the Russian front collapsed as a result of the revolution, the Assyrians, now hard-pressed by the enemy, were again, on August 20, 1918, visited by a British agent, Captain K. M. Pennington 16 of the Royal Air Force, who came to confirm on behalf of his government Captain Gracie's undertakings of the previous year and to beg them to hold on to their threatened positions until arms and munitions could reach them. Comparisons can bring no consolation to the afflicted, yet for purposes of appreciation, it must be acknowledged that while the Russians showed great admiration and loyalty to comrades in arms 17 in that a great number of their men and officers remained with the Assyrians even after the revolution to share their difficulties and tribulations, although they had made no such express commitments to the Assyrians as the British had. The British broke every promise they had made and abandoned the Assyrians to their sad fate. Later, however, when the British foresaw the military value of the Assyrians as economic gendarmes, they urged the Assyrians to proceed to Iraq against their wishes, whose only desire was to return to their homes 18 and entrusted them with the task of policing on Britain's behalf the native Arabs, their traditional, political, and religious enemies. This anomalous procedure had unfortunate results for the Assyrians. It aroused intense resentment and inevitable revenge among the natives whenever the moment should become opportune 19. Such were the sordid motives that inspired the British in the formation of the Assyrian levies in Iraq. In good, plain English, the British had in view mainly the economy arising from the difference in pay between that of the British soldier and the Assyrian levy, and this, regardless of consequences to the right and future welfare and security of those whom the British employed in their service. In 1926, the Assyrians approached the Nansen Organization of the League for Identity Papers to enable them, if necessary, to emigrate into countries where they could obtain employment, join friends, or otherwise to improve their position. Dr. Fridtjof Nansen, the League's High Commissioner for Refugees, was anxious to afford them the assistance of his office, but the Colonial Office, through its delegate at the League Council, Sir Austin Chamberlain, strenuously opposed the extension of the Nansen passport system to the Assyrians and advanced arguments, too fantastic to mention, in attempts to prove that they could not be regarded as refugees. And even after their admission to the benefits of the organization, His Majesty's Transport Minister Burgin once more declared at the League's Assembly in 1934 that the Assyrians were not refugees but a minority. There are a myriad of incidents, but this one is too dramatic and merits a mention, tending to prove the imperial policy of opposition to a departure of the Assyrians from the Middle East, and this at any price. The League Secretariat devised a scheme of settlement in South America, and to that end sent out a mission to Brazil 20 consisting of Brig. General Brown, who commended the confidence of the Assyrians, readed the Swiss Charge d'Affaires, and T.F. Johnson, that valiant member of the Militia Christi, who sacrificed personal cupidity to international interests so steadfastly. Upon arrival in Brazil in 1934, this very able commission found, to its utter amazement and despite Brown's eulogies of the Assyrians, that a national agitation had started in the press against the reception of the Assyrians for a permanent home. They were systematically slandered as turbulent Asiatics, and held to be Muslims with the Marshman in his patriarchal robes as their Muslim chief. 2. After the armistice, the British concentrated the Assyrians in refugee camps in Iraq and promised them either an enclave or arrangement for safe and decent 21 existence. But the implementation of this undertaking, ordered the Colonial Office, must wait for the conclusion of formal peace with Turkey. Hence, the peace negotiations with Turkey became fitful and protracted. The British were primarily moved to this policy of delay and evasion by ulterior considerations. Their political eye was directed to the rich oil fields of Mosul 22, and to that end their military power and uncanny genius for diplomacy were pressed into service. They knew that if the question of Mosul, the sovereignty of which was under discussion at Geneva between Turkey and Britain, which claimed it for Iraq, were shelved, it would ultimately be settled in Britain's favour. It was an imperialistic trick, a new way in which British imperialism seems to operate. With significant irony, the Lausanne Conference left the Mosul problem open and referred it to the Council of the League. Kemalist Turkey argued before the League that the Mosul area was inhabited predominantly by Turks and that geographically it was an indivisible part of Turkey. Britain alleged, on the other hand, that it belonged geographically to Iraq and fortified its claim via Iraq, her protogo, by the moral force of the plausible argument that 23. A League Frontier Commission was then sent to the spot in September 1925, and in a large measure, moved by the plausibility of the British arguments on behalf of the Assyrians, the League gave, November 1925, the province of Hakkari, the former home of the Assyrians, to Turkey, but directed the inclusion of Mosul in Iraq with a British mandate to administer the whole for a period of 25 years, dating from 1923, with the express understanding that 24. It was on these terms that the province of Mosul was assigned to Iraq, and it was on these terms that Iraq accepted it. In order to reassure them as to their future, stated Miss Gertrude Bell 25, the greatest exponent of the Iraqi independence, two successive Iraq cabinets officially pledged Iraq to provide lands in Iraq for those Assyrians, and to devise a system of administration for them which would ensure to them the utmost possible freedom from interference. It can hardly be doubted that this liberal attitude on the part of the Iraqi government had its influence on the deliberations of the Frontier Commission. In this settlement of their case, the Assyrians demanded nothing of Iraq. It was the League of Nations which insisted and stipulated that the Assyrians had definite, substantial rights in the region. Notwithstanding this, Iraq would not permit the Assyrians to form a single community but planned to divide them into villages 26 of not more than 100 families each and establish them in barren soil where malaria was rampant in the effort of scattering them throughout the country so as to destroy their national and spiritual unity. Did Iraq make generous offers of settlement to the Assyrians? Nothing can be more palpably false. In 1933, there were 20,000 Assyrians that were homeless, and those that held land were constantly in danger of eviction as they were merely serfs and tenants at will, and their lands were ample and fertile only in diseases, thorns, and scorpions 27. The circumstances which led to the unjust solution of the contest over Mosul conclusively prove that there was something incongruous about Britain's tender regard for the downtrodden Assyrians. The struggle for Mosul was simply a struggle for oil, the most essential commodity for modern industry and warfare. The Assyrians 28, being a people of the precept of seek ye first the kingdom of God, miscalculated, alas, the good intentions of the imperial government. The greatest Christian empire on earth used moral principles merely as a plausible argument to attain a materialistic end, and when that end was attained, she would no longer consider of right and wrong when, and particularly when, such questions had reference to the penniless Assyrians and other minorities. Lord Halifax 29 gave a realistic expression to this imperialistic behaviour when he candidly admitted, at times moral considerations must give way to imperial policy. And, in the name of moral justice, let us ask, was there in reality any terrible oppression by the despicable Turk? The Assyrians, who enjoyed an autonomous existence in Turkey 30 since the 13th century, and into whose territory the Turkish writ did not run, must surely know the answer, and in these days of dispersion and exile of their nation and church, they must surely remember with nostalgia the good old days of the Ottoman Empire. An exceedingly curious situation arose on May 21, 1924, at the Conference of Constantinople which dealt with the preliminaries of the contest over the Vilayet of Mosul. It was the contention of Fethi Bey of Turkey that no cession of land to the Assyrian territory was a necessity as the Assyrians could still find in Turkey the tranquility and prosperity which they enjoyed for centuries. To this, Sir Percy Cox replied that Fethi Bey's assertion did not square with the Assyrians' own views and that they had the most vivid memory of the treatment they had suffered in the past at the hands of the Turks, which they could neither forget nor ever forgive. 31. There are three observations one cannot escape making in this connection. To say the bare minimum, first, the Assyrians were completely ignorant of the latter situations. They had neither the physical prestige nor the aid of great nations, nor did they ever know that they had authorized Sir Percy to speak on their behalf, which he did with obvious grace and dignity. The Assyro-Iraqi debate took place under the vast shadow of a mighty empire, cocksure of its own mission and place in the universe. The opinion of others did not matter, they were too academic. Second, the Assyrians of today are in danger of complete extinction, and if that were allowed to occur, the British will have succeeded in doing in the course 32 of 30 years what the Ottoman Turk failed to do in the course of many centuries. Third, despite his unctuous voice of omniscience, Dr. Van S. seems to lack the slightest familiarity with the Assyrian problem in Iraq. He is about as familiar with the above events as he is with logic, relevancy, fairness, missionary motif, and Christian charity. That which is applicable to this section of the book is applicable to the entire. A schoolboy would scarcely have been excusable for writing such literature. 3. Contrary to Dr. Van S.'s presumption, the Assyrians in Iraq are not a minority. People who flee from political danger in search of an asylum as a result of war are refugees. This is by the dictionary, and such exactly is the status of the Assyrians in Iraq. They are immigrants from southeastern Anatolia, who fled from the Turk during World War I, and were made to seek refuge in Iraq. They had nothing whatever in common with the Arab inhabitants of the land. 33. The Assyrians in Iraq are stateless, mere sojourners, and some of the most honored aristocrats of the international tramps. The definition 34 of the Assyrian refugee, adopted by the League in 1928, when they were finally admitted to the Nansen Fold, is dispositive of this phase of the issue. Any person of Assyrian or Assyro-Chaldean origin, and also by assimilation any person of Syrian or Kurdish origin, who does not enjoy or who no longer enjoys the protection of the state to which he previously belonged, and who has not acquired or does not possess another nationality. 35. This question of status was again revived in 1932, when Dr. Petros, 36, of the Baz, an Assyrian physician, exposed the intolerable condition of the Assyrian refugees in Iraq. The Reverend Mr. R. C. Cumberland, 37, a missionary in Iraq, volunteered to refute Dr. Petros' charges vigorously. Captain Philip Mumford, for years a British intelligence officer in Iraq, analyzed 38 the two divergent views and concluded that the truth lies nearer to Dr. Petros' complaint than to Mr. Cumberland's explanation. Mr. Cumberland, he went on to say, refutes the claim of the Assyrians to the description of refugees. What else are they? Tragic indeed was the end of Mr. Cumberland in Iraq. During a period of 18 years of missionary pursuit, only one Muslim Kurd was reported to have been Christianized. This Kurd had come to adopt the gospel as his code of conduct, however, not as a result of Mr. Cumberland's missionary work, but in consequence of the former connection with the Assyrians. On hearing of this incident, he zealously journeyed a distance of 2 days to pay a visit to the new Christian and candidly succeeded in deluding himself into the belief that the Christianization of this gentleman of the hills was one of the successful achievements of his career. And he so reported to the Presbyterian Board of Foreign Missions in New York City. One fatal day he was visited at his residence in Dohuk by two unidentified Arabs. That was before sunrise on June 12, 1938. Suddenly their pistols and daggers went into action, and, the Rev. 1 Veer? Ah, C. Cumberland and his servant were to see the rise of the sun no more. 39. His unfortunate wife and two minor children were present. His assailants were said to have accused him of complicity in the independence movement of the Kurds. The matter of his guilt or innocence was not submitted to an inquest. From all accounts, the charges were utterly unfounded, and there was not a scintilla of evidence of guilt to sustain them. This unhappy man of religion was merely occupied in the vain, futile technique of proselyting. He had nothing to do whatsoever with the noble struggle of the Kurd to free himself from the Arab yoke. 4. Truth is not on the side of the Reverend Mr. Van S. in his baseless assertion that there was no region available to settle the Assyrians in a compact body. In his frank eagerness to fulfill the terms of his promise to the Arabs of Iraq, he loses all sense of historic reality. Before World War I, Mesopotamia, now named Iraq, was part of the Turkish Empire, and since its dismemberment, Iraq was placed, January 1, 1918, under the British mandate on behalf of the League, pursuant to the 12th of President Wilson's 14 points, assuring the nationalities, then under Turkish rule, of an undoubted security of life and an absolutely unmolested opportunity of autonomous development. To give effect to this principle, Britain created an Arab regime in 1920 and an Arab monarchy in 1921 under the nominal leadership of King Faisal XL, consonant with the joint declaration of Great Britain and France, November 30, 1918, to the effect that the end they had in view was the complete and definite liberation of the peoples so long oppressed by the Turks and the establishment of national government and administrations drawing their authority from the initiative and free choice of indigenous populations, in 1930, after negotiating the Anglo-Iraq Treaty of Alliance and financial agreement which were to place the control of the main oil fields rid railways into the hands of the British magnates, Britain undertook to terminate its mandate by urging the unconditional entry of Iraq into the League of Nations in 1932. This indigenous Arab population of Iraq was prior to 1918 under the Iron Heel of the Turk, and as such, the great majority were willing to renounce their claim not only to the territory north of Mosul, which was recommended by the Permanent Mandates Commissioners adopted by the League to be a home for the Assyrians, but to the entire province of Mosul with its rich oil fields, if by doing so, their independence could be accelerated 41 and vouchsafed. Infinitely more significant and relevant than this is the statement of May, 1924, made by the late Sir Henry Conway Dobbs 42, His Britannic Majesty's then High Commissioner for Iraq.
H.E. The High Commissioner has ascertained that there are more than sufficient deserted lands, the property of the Iraq government to the north of Dohuk in Amadia and the northern hills, upon which the Assyrians could be permanently settled.
To Sir Henry's averment must be added the conclusions of the Permanent Mandates Commission 43 holding that it had not been proved to the satisfaction of an impartial observer that lands combining the requisite conditions for the settlement of the Assyrians in a homogeneous group did not exist in Iraq. V. The historic sequence of events which led to the termination of the mandate entirely falsify Dr. Van S. contentions that the Assyrians took matters into their own hands after the termination of the mandate in 1932, and that there was a state of rebellion against the government. When in the meeting of the Permanent Mandates Commission of the League, that considered the application of Iraq for admission, grave apprehension was voiced about her spirit of tolerance toward the Assyrians and other religious and racial minorities, Lord Cecil and the British High Commissioner, Sir Francis Humphreys 44, assured the Commission that Iraq's spirit of tolerance was above suspicion. The Commission, however, especially its very able, Pierre Orts, was less optimistic, and sarcastically amazed at the rapid progress of Iraq towards political maturity. As a matter of common knowledge, Iraq was a politically backward 45 country, and did not possess the necessary qualifications for sovereignty. The late Thomas Lyle 46, as a result of his practical experience in the civil administration and as district magistrate of Baghdad, stated in 1923 that the Arabs of Iraq needed 70 to 100 years to learn the advantages of self-government and that they only desired self-government as an opportunity to escape from all law and order. Nevertheless, the British persisted in strongly supporting the candidature of Iraq even to the extent of stating 47. His Majesty's government realizes the responsibility in recommending that Iraq should be admitted to the League, which is, in its view, the only legal way of terminating the mandate. Should Iraq prove herself unworthy of the confidence which has been placed in her, The moral responsibility must rest with HM's government, which would not attempt to transfer it to the Mandates Commission. Solely influenced by this declaration 48, and after washing their hands 49 publicly of any moral responsibility should anything untoward occur, the Commission reluctantly decided in January 1932 to recommend Iraq's admission, and when the mandate, October 1932, was brought to an end, the Iraqis, in the words of Dorothy Thompson 50, celebrated their new independence with a massacre of the Assyrians. The preceding significant pronouncement on the assumption of moral responsibility made by Sir Francis is for its absurdity alleged extravagance unexceeded in the annals of chicanery. In 1930, Sir Francis frankly admitted that the Assyrians are naturally apprehensive of what is likely to happen when the British mandate is terminated 51, and that when that occurred, the responsibility for minorities would have to be fulfilled by Iraq towards the League direct, and not through the British government as at present. When the massacre was a thing of the past, the British took the position, according to the true course of international law, that no state 52 could interfere with the internal affairs of another sovereign state, and obstructed every attempt at investigation into the affairs of the massacre. Apportionment of blame, declared Sir John Simon at Geneva, in the meeting of the League Council of October 14, 1933, is a barren proceeding. Bitterly disappointed with the action of the British government 53 in renouncing its mandate, after the lapse of only 7 of the contemplated 25 years, without settling the Assyrian problem, His Holiness Mar-e-Shah Shimon 23, 119th Patriarch of the Church of the East and of the Assyrians, then at the age of 24, proceeded to Geneva to make a final, desperate plea for his people with a special emphasis on the vital problem of a homogeneous group, which had been promised to them by the Permanent Mandates Commission of the League. Iraq, however, apparently vexed at this appeal to the League, and realizing that the Mar-Shimon was opposed to the government's policy of a heterogeneous settlement, invited His Holiness, May, 1933, to Baghdad under the false pretense 54 to discuss matters, and placed him under detention, and, subsequent to the massacre, he was to be deported to Cyprus on August 18, 1933, in defiance of the fundamental laws and League guarantees. On July 11 and 12, 1933, several meetings were held in Mosul, at the special instance of the government, during which time Lieutenant Colonel R. S. Stafford 55, Major D. B. Thompson 56, and the local Mutazar 57, advised the other Assyrian leaders that those who disapprove the land settlement policy of the government could leave the country. 58. The essential design of this conspiracy was to drive the Assyrians into what they might style rebellion that would furnish the pretense for a program of unconscionable extermination of the Assyrians. Completely disillusioned 59 and convinced that no fair play could be had in Iraq, certain Assyrian representative leaders, with some hundreds of their men, elected to leave Iraq for settlement in the north of Syria, carrying their arms legally acquired, but repudiating 60 all idea of rebellion. This was revealed in a letter 61 they dispatched to the Ministry of the Interior on July 23, informing the government of their exodus and requesting the government not to molest their families in Iraq. However, for justifiable reasons, these Assyrians returned from Syria, and while they were recrossing 62 the Tigris on August 4, 1933, the Iraqi army fired on the Assyrians, who naturally 63 retaliated. The news of the battle was broadcast throughout Iraq by the government, declaring that it was the Assyrians who had first opened fire at the scene. It was a malicious fabrication of facts. That these Assyrians fired at the Iraqi post is an assertion that cannot be entitled to credit. This controversial argument contradicts itself in point of possibility. These few hundred Assyrians could not have been the aggressor, they had their families in Iraq. His Grace the Lord Archbishop of Canterbury was amazed at the use of the term rebellion. "It cannot be fairly described as rebellion," cried out His Grace in the House of Lords 64. "They were told to go and find a new home if they could. Why?" In the Battle of August 4 to the 5th, 1933, which followed the attack on the Assyrians, the Iraqi army was completely dislodged, only to be rescued by the intervention of the Royal Air Force. Here is the unimpeachable testimony 65 of a disinterested ex-British civil commissioner of Iraq. But the position in which the British government has placed itself today in Iraq is as intolerable as it is unparalleled. British advisers, whose advice is not asked, a British military mission forced to be silent spectators of foul deeds, four squadrons of the British Air Force, whose intervention has been confined of recent months to dropping leaflets on the Assyrians telling them to surrender. They did so, and were massacred a day or two later in cold blood. These vaunted Assyrians who saved the British Army from utter disaster 66 in 1920, could not have been defeated otherwise. The courage and assertiveness of the Assyrians with a Highland genius for mountain warfare, admitted Captain Gracie, made them a terror to their enemies and a pride to those who commanded them. The regular British troops of 1919-20 undertook many punitive expeditions against the northern Kurds 67, but the Kurds were percent finally defeated only by the Assyrians, although they were heavily outnumbered and out-munitioned. It was this successful stroke on the part of the Assyrians at a critical moment, asserts Sir Arnold, that put an end to all further outbreaks. In one engagement alone, the Kurds suffered losses greater than ever inflicted by all punitive expeditions alluded to above. And when the Arabs of Iraq rose against the government, the Assyrians proved themselves to be more than a match for them. Indeed, so valuable was their assistance to the hard-pressed British that General Aylmer Haldane 68 was led to declare. But for this entirely fortuitous support, it is possible that a large portion of the Mosul division might have been swamped in this wave of anarchy. Unsurpassingly glorious as the record of the Levies 69, some of the most valuable and spectacular services of the Assyrians have been rendered by ordinary clansmen 70, not enlisted in the levies. The Assyrians, who were the first to inflict defeat upon the Arab insurgents in 1920 between Baghdad and the Persian frontier, and those who did very good work between Baghdad and Mosul, were not levies but ordinary clansmen acting spontaneously on their own responsibility. Similarly, those who twice averted disaster in the Mosul division were ordinary clansmen. It would be an act of ungenerosity not to record here, parenthetically at least, that during the 3 days massacre, the heroic Kurds were the only element to offer shelter to the martyred Assyrians, although they were incited to do otherwise. This friendly sentiment between the Kurds and the Assyrians was not a matter of novel impression. In 1910, the Sheikh of Barzan and his family took refuge with the Assyrians in Tumah from the Turks and enjoyed complete safety. Their new rulers, however, were now being tutored in the cunning motto of divide et impera. Just prior to the massacre, strife was stirred up between the Kurds and the Assyrians to destroy each other. A petition emanating from Baghdad was circulated by an agent in Mosul throughout Kurdistan urging all Mohammedans to declare a holy war on the Assyrians. The Kurds of both Roundouts and Barzan happily understood its evil purpose and actively refused to collaborate according to its tenor 71. Roundouts was then under the leadership of Ismail Beg, the young Kurdish nobleman, who stated so constantly that were it not for the pressure imported from without, the Kurds and the Assyrians would have lived in a state of absolute cordiality. Alas! That he was to be assassinated at an early age, his long life would have brought glory to Kurdistan. And why was fighting carried on by the Arabs against Sheikh Ahmed of Barzan? Partly because of his leaning towards Christianity 72. This chief of the tribes of Barzan was accused, and not without an element of truth, of being a young man with strange ideas about the Mohammedan religion. For a time he was said to have become half-Christian and invited friendship with the Assyrians. At once propaganda was spread throughout Kurdistan saying that he was plotting with the Assyrians to suppress all Mohammedans 73. From the example of Ahmed there emerges one principle of unprecedented importance: Christianity is essentially an Oriental faith, and the non-Christian races in the Near and Middle East will not accept that faith unless they can learn to respect the native Christians whom they meet in their daily life. The remotest expectation of achieving genuine success in conversion by merely changing the labels worn by different sections of native Christians, the practice of the Western missionaries in this part of the East, is the most incurable symptom of the decay of Christian missions. having come to the East with the most honest intention of converting the Muslims, and learning in time the futility of their undertaking, these missionaries, Catholic and Protestant alike, turned to the native Christians as a fertile field for converts. Among the Assyrians, if my boyhood recollections are accurate, life was a pleasant sojourn, Sunday a fit time for worship, as well as for visiting, eating, general recreation and drinking. It was the children's best play day. This solemn holiday of exceeding joy and gladness definitely existed for children, not vice versa. The Brotherhood of Mante ideal of the founder of the church would become an accomplished fact only when people became children at heart again, for in them the world is one. Except ye become as little children. To the missionary, however, such Sunday performances were incomprehensible. How could a Christian father permit his children to thus defile the Lord's Day? Lacking, then, a real appreciation of the tenets of the old-fashioned moral code of the East, that distinguished themselves from those of the puritanical ones, they were bringing up their new converts, with extremely few exceptions, to be neither the one thing nor the other but all confused and negative. This new conversion created an irreparable schism among Christians who had accepted Christ 1,000 years before the forefathers of these same missionaries had themselves been converted to Christianity from dark, idol-worshipping paganism. To be sure, the establishment of mission schools and hospitals among them, for which every decent native is grateful, will always remain the most admirable contribution of the missionary zeal and devotion. But what the native Christians suffered in spiritual debasement in consequence of the spirit of antipathy of different sects of the selfsame religion toward one another, engendered among them by the modern, zealous missionary, is beyond estimation. No, such is not the function of the missionary. The true missionary task consists in bringing the blessings of faith to those who have them not. And since this primary task has been fruitless among the Mohammedans for over a century, all missionary endeavor must necessarily apply itself to the uplifting of the native Christians and leave the conversion of the Islamic races to the future 74. Such was the ideal that motivated the actions of the Anglican mission. Its express object was to strengthen the ancient church and not to draw anyone from the flock of that church into new and strange folds. The finest works in recent times about the Assyrians, their customs, religion, and culture have come out of the heart of the Archbishop of Canterbury's Assyrian mission that was established in the Assyrian mountains in 1886, Canons A.J. McLean, W.H. Brown, and W.A. Wigram are but few of the many illustrious knights of Christ whose labors of love will reflect everlasting fame and glory upon the office of the Archbishop of Canterbury. The heroism of the Assyrians in defeating the Axis-planned rebellion in Habaniah 75 near Baghdad again in 1941, when Iraq tried to stab Britain in the back by calling in Hitler's Luftwaffe, still echoes in the Middle East. It was here that the Assyrian levies crushed Rashid Ali Gailani's forces into impotence and forced him to flee to his paymasters in Berlin. The British Air Commodore J.L. Vachel, qualified in the extreme by virtue of intimacy 76, brings to the world's attention the achievements of the Assyrians' our smallest ally as he calls them by the following unanswerable, truthful and moving statement, which alone would sustain their claim to recognition. The period between the two wars, the Assyrians were primarily responsible for safeguarding our airfields in Iraq and for providing the ground forces which are an essential complement to air control. Not only did air control in Iraq save this country many millions of pounds, but it served as a model which was extended to several parts of the empire. What is not generally appreciated is that, after severe disillusionment during that period, the services of the Assyrians during the present war have exceeded anything they did before. Had it not been for their loyalty at the time of Rashid Ali's German-inspired revolution in Iraq in May of 1941, our position in the Middle East might have become most precarious. Let the future chroniclers declare the Habaniah battle as the greatest battle 77 of World War II, the battle that decided the world's destiny. It was this Habaniah victory that had saved Iraq, and the position of the United Nations in the Middle East and more. For 3 weeks later came the invasion of Russia, and it had saved the road through Persia, which was now exceedingly vital for the transit of Allied aid to Russia. If that was to be safeguarded, Iraq must be in safe hands. By a strange coincidence of events, Habaniah helped to save the Kremlin 78 as well as Britain from a disaster worse than Dunkirk and Singapore, and this new victory was forged almost solely by the sweat and blood of the Assyrian levies. Nor was the full import of the achievement of the United Nations missed by dispassionate observers. One evening, while the fighting was still in progress, Rudolf Hess announced in Renfrewshire the terms on which Germany was prepared to end the hostilities conditioned upon, among other minor items, the evacuation of Iraq by the British. 7. Dr. Van Ess pretends that the massacre was not a premeditated act of the government. This is simply not true. Now that Iraq will secure a seat in the League, a press agent was informed by the Minister of Communications, 79, Rustam Haider, during the latter part of 1932, the extinction of the Christians in Mosul is inevitable, and is looked upon as a sacred duty of Iraq. If that opportunity does not present itself, we must find means to bring it about. Nothing ever happens suddenly in history. The massacre under review did not come overnight. It was preceded by many rehearsals, many portents and warnings. As early as 1923, precautions had to be taken against such a disaster by Colonel Beauville at the special instance of Lady Surma 80. The High Commissioner was warned again in 1932 that massacre would follow British withdrawal. Sir Francis could not deny the danger 81, seeing that during his tenure of office he had had to put a stopper at two such occasions, one in 1929 and another in 1931. All this was before Iraq had ever acquired the status of an independent state. After the surrender of the mandate, the Iraqi Cabinet 82 determined on the extermination of the infidels. In the first weeks of August, 1933, a holy war was proclaimed against the Assyrians, and the government press, officials, and deputies were in the foremost of those who advocated the Jihad 83. During the same period, over 230 anti-Assyrian articles were published and many inflammatory speeches made in Parliament 84. In addition, the details of the massacre were published in Beirut 85 before they were known in Mosul, and the government offered the Arab tribesmen £1 bounty for every Assyrian head brought in. In the circumstances, it is not a matter of surprise that attempts to punish the guilty were entirely lacking. Instead, the principal instigators were given a triumphal reception and decorated in Mosul. Reverend Van Ess does not have the humanity to disclose or admit that Bakir Sidki Bey was promoted to the rank of Pasha 86 by the cabinet only after he had become the chief executioner of the massacre. No pro-Arab fanatic can rationally be expected to do so. Flagrant omissions are the indispensable companions of unsupported assertions, gratuitous assumptions, and fallacious reasoning, and the Reverend Mr. Van Ess has shown himself to have a signal mastery of the virtues implicit in them all. At the same time, a highly inspired Massage 87 from Baghdad read: any attempt to apportion blame or impose punishment might have the most undesirable repercussions in this country, much more serious than the troubles gone before. 8. Meanwhile, as the government was thus pursuing its venomous policy, with the connivance of the British military advisers 88, which clearly aimed at the destruction and extinction of the Assyrian race and church by merging it forcibly in the body politic of Iraq, the patriarch was offered wealth for himself and his family if he would only approve their scheme of settlement. Since the scheme meant national destruction, he refused to accept it. "I take no bribe to abandon 89 my people. If this be provocation, the Assyrian leaders have, in sad truth, been provocative, and this, to the point of exasperation. This provocation recalls another hero's devotion to duty. When the Assyrians agreed to leave their country and to fight for Britain and her allies in World War I, the late Patriarch Mar Benyamin Shimon 90, uncle of the present Patriarch, was not moved by a threat from the Turks that they would hang his brother 91, who was then for 2 years a student at Constantinople at the invitation of the Turkish government, if the Assyrians rose and joined the Allies. His answer was, "Nothing would deter me from my duty. Hormizd Demirciman was accordingly murdered by the Turks in Mosul, where he was transferred for detention. There is an incident on record in the life of this young patriarch which betrays deep emotion. Upon his proclamation of war on the Central Powers in 1915, he marched at the head of the Tal Column. His route led him over a lofty mountain col near Julemerk, whence he was for the last time able to look down upon the majesty of cosmic beauty which marked the site of his own village of Quatchanis. The patriarch was dressed in a long purple ecclesiastical robe. Round his neck was a chain, and suspended from it a large pectoral cross of silver and enamel. This was the cross 92 of his office, which had been worn by successive patriarchs for at least 15 centuries. As he paused to gaze, he saw, reflected in his cross, the Patriarchate Church of Marshalitha in Quatchanis. Then one natural sigh escaped this son of Jesse: when shall I ever drink the waters of Quatchanis? Poor my Benjamin, so heroic and faithful. Where is the ancient habitation of your illustrious fathers? Where are its solemn customs and usages that made the Assyrian society an ordered whole? 3 decades ago, you brought the tribes you commanded so well from your ancestral valleys in the Hakkari fastnesses to fight in a world war for the liberty of small nations, little dreaming that it was likely to be the last fatal pilgrimage 93 of your ancient nation. The betrayal 94 of your followers by friends you once trusted is the basest in history. The lust for economic power rode roughshod over principle and promise, leaving the Assyrians stranded in a no man's land at the mercy of strange and hostile Arab tribesmen. They are now deserted, broken, and bleeding. They are dying. It was an ill day for his tribe when he led them to fight in a war for the liberty of small nations, 95 sobbed Malik Ismail, at the close of 1932. Now we have to meet death at long last. So let us prepare to face the enemy whom we know, that we may the more readily forget the desertion of those whom we once thought to be our friends, concluded stoically this head of the fighting Tiari Assyrians, one of the grimmest, most formidable warriors in his time. 9. The assassination of Bekir Sidki is part of the logical sequel to the Assyrian cause. It has a spiritual significance much deeper than can be apprehended by Dr. Van S. In it is to be perceived the outline of divine justice, perhaps. Incidentally, the crises that have taken place of late in the capitals of the world seem to entirely repudiate Carlyle's assumption that God sits in his heaven and does nothing. Victory does not, in itself, establish a lasting peace or the condition for peace. A cessation of hostility is no revelation of a future that is without any element of apprehension. Let the tinsel captains who guide the destiny of empires be vigilant. Let the nations now engaged in peace conversations learn in the way of grim maturity that the horrors will come again, magnified beyond anything the world has seen, unless they behold in this triumph of arms but a golden opportunity to lay a foundation for just peace in which all, great or small, may be guaranteed a safe and decent existence. 96. Bekir Sidki was the son of a Turkish provincial governor. He was born in 1890 near Kirkuk and entered the Turkish army at the age of 18 when he gained a reputation as a ruthless soldier. During World War I he served on the Turkish staff and had a deep admiration for Turkey and Germany. His wife was German. In 1932, he visited England and attended courses at the Staff College, Camberley. In 1933, he conducted the Assyrian massacre as the chief agent of the Iraqi government. In 1936, he launched a which resulted in the murder of his rival, Defense Minister Jafar al-Askari. On the evening of August 11, 1937, General Sidki and Air Chief Muhammad Ali Jawad were sitting on the bench at the Mosul airport, admiring the setting of the sun while waiting for a plane to fly to Turkey to witness the Turkish army maneuvers. In the gathering darkness their cigarettes glowed peacefully. Captain Mahmoud Hindi sidled near and suddenly appeared from the shadows, revolver in hand. Bekir Sidki did not have time to toss away his smoke. A succession of shots shook the air and the general pitched forward dead. Major Jawad leapt at the assailant but he, too, fell forward on his face. And so, the malevolent spirit that lived by violence died by violence. This was a poetic justice, for August the 11th was the exact day on which he had ordered the Samil massacre in 1933. Bakir Siddiqui is but one of the many sinners who suffered such a brutal end, which must now be a matter of indifference to the Assyrians, for they belong to the past. Let them rest in the grave they dug for themselves. The cause of the Assyrians is a matter of human right. Let their appeal to the conscience of humanity, based upon the merit of their services to humanity, continue until a safe home is found where calm reigns. 97 As Major Douglas V. Duff, that disinterested fighting prophet, remarked, Britain and Britain alone is primarily responsible for the sad fate of the Assyrians. 98. Had the specific acts of commission and omission of the few mean-soured politicians in the colonial office those shocking examples of imperialist cynicism and deception as Pierre Van Pussen calls them been properly uncovered before the good English people, they would ere this have been reduced to shameful and awe-struck silence. For in the presence of such apocalyptic events, no one, no, not even the moon and the stars, can be neutral. This is the superlative responsibility which the Assyrian National Federation cannot evade. Let it, then, muster and set in motion sufficient moral and political energy through the press in establishing public sentiment in favor of a re-examination of the Assyrian cause by the powers that are, and this with malice towards none. I have now gone through all the absurdities and profaneness of the author's observations. If these annotated commentaries are false, it is a duty incumbent on him to refute them. If they are true, the publication of his book is the most diabolical fraud ever perpetrated upon the reading public. Among the cruel persecutions which the Christian Assyrians have suffered through many centuries, the attacks of Dr. Van S. are the foulest. The spiritual representative of the Board of Foreign Mission of the Reformed Church has crusaded in the East against the Assyrian nation and church with the tenacity of a bulldog. Indeed, could they but find their tongue, they would force the biblical cry which solemnly said, Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me? For the sordidness of motivation, his writings are unexcelled. If the Iraq government's case were better known, wrote 99 he at a time when the fortunes of the Assyrians seemed to be at their very darkest 100, the sympathy which has been excited for the Assyrians in Europe and America, would be discovered 101 to be not so well founded. These martyred, disappointed, disillusioned, and decimated Assyrians are the spiritual descendants of the pioneer missionaries 102 of the Church of the East who won souls for Christ from the 1st century to the 15th century. They carried the cross as a sign and proclaimed the good tidings of love and charity. By magnifying the Christian virtues, they led others to evaluate them, and their evaluation often culminated in the adoption of the cross of Christ. They were not parasites. Unimpeachable evidence reveals that they poured into their calling soul-stirring and mind-awakening stuff of life. The speaking stone in Xi'an Fu is their undying testimony. To the legion of Chinese of those centuries, the Assyrian Christianity was the luminous religion. We make an effort to give it that appellation, they said, because this true and eternal system of doctrine is wonderful, its merits and uses manifest 103 and brilliant. The Reverend Mr. Van S. was sent to the Middle East to preach the Christian faith among the Muslims. Meet the Arab contains little about his missionary effort or its fruits, not a single example of Muslim conversion. 104. That he has become a persecutor in the widest sense of the term is the direct consequence of a moral failure. It suggests a sense of guilt. A pusillanimous attack upon a Christian minority which seeks nothing but the preservation of its spiritual unity in lands hostile to its faith by one supposedly a messenger of the gospel is a contradiction of both the letter and the spirit of that gospel. It betrays cold cynicism, deep-seated hypocrisy, moral perversity, and Christian perfidy. In view of the woes of the Assyrian nation and church, can it be said that Christianity is without a share of responsibility? Besides uttering statements of sympathy, at best, for their agony and the constant deepening of their anguish, The Church of Christ has stood like an eternal constant, the constancy of neutrality, the constancy of abdication of vision of things just and of good report in favor of mundane praise and consideration, the constancy of impotence in the presence of political injustice and high misdemeanor, ecstatically content with the preachment of abstract eternal truths, without the slightest view of translating them into daily language, or adapting them to the exigencies of the time. Indeed, by confusing the proclamation with the application of eternal verities, the Church has lost her spiritual leadership, irretrievably. She is no longer a great uplifting and conserving agency in the world. One cannot help wonder, meanwhile, how weary the God's most ancient people and Church, the descendants 105 of the custodians of the Cross of Christ, must be with the endless but inane protestations of sympathy that emanate from holy places, marble churches, and oak-paneled vestries. Are not Christian statesmen, the world over, ready to match their oft-repeated words with concrete action and right now? The averment in the foreword that the present Assyrians are the Assyrians of antiquity is now made self-evident. 106. The Bible in Aramaic. Aramaic was the lingua franca during the Assyrian and Babylonian rule and the literary and colloquial language of Mesopotamia, Palestine, Syria, and Asia Minor from the 7th century BC to the 9th century AD. It was the mother tongue of the New Testament writers who were divinely inspired to write the original text, 107, and it is the vernacular of the Assyrians and the Chaldeans of today. Peshitta, the original Aramaic version of the Holy Writ then, is the earliest and most authoritative document, 108, and, quite naturally, it was written in the language in which Jesus, his disciples, and the early Christians spoke. 109. The revised version was written in a pedantic semi-Greek jargon full of startling variations from the original text. 110. Due to the inability of the Greek translators to express in their own tongue Aramaic colloquialisms, metaphors, and shades in meaning. Any dogmatic assertion, therefore, that the Bible, in divers modern languages, is translated from the original Greek must lack the extrinsic elements of accuracy. According to the ancient, the spiritual and temporal leadership of the Assyrians has been vested in the patriarch who always assumes the name Marshimon, Lord Simon, Mar being a title given to saints and bishops of their church. This authority has been hereditary for approximately 600 years in one family, 111, and the patriarch being celibate, his office descends from uncle to nephew and thus keeps it in the episcopal house. 112. The present patriarch, Eshai Marshimon, who was consecrated in 1920 at the age of 13, is the 119th Catholicos of the East from Saint Simon, called Saint Peter, Saint Thomas, Saint Thaddeus, and Saint Mary, founders of the Church of the East, and the 23rd from his holy family. There is no historical justification for the mythical theory that Nestorius was the founder of the Assyrian Church. 113. The term Nestorian is a nickname given to this Christian community because of their hospitality and service to the Christian refugees who sought asylum in Persia in consequence of their condemnation as double-nature heretics and banishment from the Roman Empire. It would be an act not in the pursuit of moderation to go at this time into the motive that actuated the conduct of Cyril of Alexandria, or of the Emperor Zeno in and after the Third Council of Ephesus held in 431 AD. Suffice it to say that Nestorianism as applied to the Assyrian Christians is not a proper appellation, it is a misnomer. Even the Roman Giesus Emani, a Maronite archbishop and librarian of the Vatican, who wrote their history in four salutary volumes, failed and oddly to call them Nestorians. He calls them Assyrians or Chaldeans. 114. And properly, when the visions of the Apocalypse were first revealed, the Trans-Euphratian was the capital portion of their prosperous church. 115. The Church of the East grew up in apostolic times outside the Roman Empire and east of the Euphrates and was a powerful church for 400 years before the birth of Nestorius. To be sure, the Assyrian Christians to this very day call themselves Nestorians, even as the Friends call themselves Quakers, but only in a good-humored concession to the misunderstanding of others. There is not, there never was, such a thing as the Nestorian Church, and, neither Jacobites nor Nestorians, be it said, hold the heresies which their nicknames suggest and which their enemies credited with teaching. 116. In the days when Western Europe was sunk in the Dark Ages, there was the most aggressive missionary force in Christendom. With a heroic charity, she sent forth a succession of missionaries who should announce the kingdom of God and extend the foundations of the Church universal in regions beyond her own. That communion extended in time from the 1st century to nearly the middle of the 16th century, and in space from the Mediterranean to the Pacific and from the Indian Ocean to the Caspian. There stood the Church at the close of the 16th century in the full majesty of her contribution to mankind's spiritual progress. Hated and persecuted, humbled to the dust, the Church militant survived all and mocked at her destruction. Since that period, the Assyrians as a Christian nation have suffered bitter persecutions and unparalleled martyrdom at the hands of non-Christians. It has been said of the Assyrians that it is a marvel that they have survived to this day, and that it would be a disaster of the greatest magnitude 117 if they were allowed to disappear from the face of the earth and truthfully. A people who have displayed such heroism in the presence of physical danger, and in favor of the allied nations in two world wars from the time the immortal Mar Benyamin held aloft his cross and led his Christian army, and such pertinacity for the Christian faith against the fiercest opposition can again become the worthy inheritors of their own splendid past if their continued corporate existence is guaranteed the spontaneous yearning of every Assyrian 118 as he marches up and down on the highways and byways of the Near and Middle East, the Caucasus, and all over the known world, as a member of the band of lost souls. The nation that will be instrumental in gathering these fragments of our common humanity under one roof will everlastingly stand as the most glaring arsenal of rare beneficence. It is one of the least known, but the worthiest and the best, causes ever beheld by the sun. To the United States of America comes one of the great moments of history. Her philosophy has made her mightier than the mightiest nation on earth. America's physical survival was not a pressing problem in World War I. She coveted no conquest, no dominion. With a clear conscience, with absolutely no selfish desire and purpose, America was drawn into the affairs of that political convulsion as a single champion of freedom, justice, peace, and universal dominion of moral right over physical might. And as a good Samaritan, she came to hold with one hand the mighty rod of justice and equity, with the other, the soothing cup of mercy and charity for all mankind. Had consistency and wiser counsel prevailed, her unselfish mandates would have been respected by all. Had the ideals of that war not abdicated, the world might have been safe, democracy and the earth would not have been covered again with a deluge of blood. Even so, let us not presume that the dead of World War I gave up their lives in vain. Those who died in loyalty to comrades and in obedience to orders, those who consciously fought for human liberty, have not perished vainly. Something survived out of the ruins of the young lives, out of the lost illusions, out of the dead hopes. World War II happened because the ideals of World War I were betrayed, because when the awful choice had to be made, America, and the free nations, would not finally betray the ideals of World War I. For the preservation and perpetuation of those ideals, America has made a gigantic sacrifice. Her economic losses are never to be restored. And what of her grief? Time has somewhat softened the grief of 1918, but that of 1945 still aches in thousands of American hearts, in millions of hearts the world over. Neither praise nor posthumous medals can cure that pain. The only way in which America can justify those sacrifices is to see the end of the war as a chance, a real chance, only a chance freely purchased with the lives of hundreds and thousands of Americans to lead the world in the paths of peace, security, and spiritual values. To resolve that this shall be so, that neither pride nor greed, neither hate nor fear, shall stand in the way, is to do honor to the dead. To be sure, these days of newborn peace are also days of crisis, yet no nation in history has been in a better position to use its influence for world good and lasting peace. James Reston reminded us in his Prelude to Peace that the Chinese require two words in order to spell the word crisis. One word was danger, the other opportunity. The end of the war has produced a crisis in and out of America, true, but alongside the danger is an opportunity of such dimensions as history has never before seen. By tolerance, by wisdom, and by leadership, our country can help guide the caravan of history to a brighter frontier. May it never be said of America for the sake of America that she, in her hour of supreme crisis, was so engrossed in the danger of that crisis that she failed to see the opportunity it presented.